You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
This is Diana Lair with Yale Radio on the lives of artists, and today we've got Anthony Howe. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, thank you.
I read that you started out as a painter. You know, what happened that evolved into what you're doing now, these incredible kinetic sculptures?
I was living in the woods in New Hampshire, where I'd built a home on the top of a mountain, thinking that was the nirvana, to have a studio in the woods. And I was single at the time, and I kind of went out of my mind, and I lost my focus on what I was painting. I didn't like what I was painting, and I became completely blocked. Couldn't paint anymore. Without selling the home, I moved to New York City and decided I needed to figure whatever it was out about what I was doing. And painting just deteriorated further. And I was the super for in a warehouse and had a penthouse apartment on the top of the warehouse. My day job was erecting steel shelving for the storage of office records. So I had all this steel around, and I started making things with my hands. The first thing I made was a heart for a girlfriend, a wannabe girlfriend, and I just felt such immense pleasure from doing that that I realized I should be making things. And that evolved into since it was a rooftop, there was a lot of wind. I had some elevator cables, which I stretched between two buildings, and started hanging work from that. And at that time, just as soon as I bought a welder and started welding the steel together, it was like I had my imagination exploded with all kinds of possibilities. And I just knew that was what I needed to do.
And were you thinking in terms of movement at that time, or just in terms of, you know, static sculpture?
I was definitely thinking in terms of movement. My youth was a lot of working in my father's shop with my hands, making 3D objects.
What kind of shop did he have?
Just a garage shop.
Okay.
You know, nothing fancy. But I made a lot of gizmos with electric motors and wood projects. I went to Taft, a prep school.
Mm-hmm.
The focus at Taft was not on shop and working with your hands. It was on English literature, and you know what that is.
Academics,
all about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we did have a great teacher painting, a painter at Taft at that time, and I could sell whatever I painted, and I thought, this is what I want to do, based just on the fact that I could sell them. So that was the real inspiration was working with my hands in 3D objects, which took me 20 years to figure out after going through the educational system.
I can imagine. And also there's a lot of engineering that I would think needs to go into these pieces. So that's a whole learning curve that I would assume took a long time.
It definitely did. And it's absolutely, there's no shortcut for that. Even an engineer, I don't think, could just start making wind sculptures successfully, knowing everything they did. There's so much trial and error to get this right.
So when you are trying to figure out how it will behave in a very light breeze versus if you have very heavy, I mean, do you have to take all of that into consideration? And are some more geared for slower winds, or are they really, because they're outside, I suppose they have to work in under every condition that happens?
Yeah, they really do have to work in both the lightest and the strongest. People are not, generally, the average wind speeds around the world are under 8 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to place a sculpture and not be particular about where it's going, it has to spin in those lighter winds, but it also has to withstand 90 mile an hour winds.
And not come apart.
Yeah.
What material are you using, because they're outdoors and they don't rust?
Everything is pretty much stainless.
Okay.
Now, I did used to use copper, but copper is more difficult to work with in terms of developing the needed strength. It's much more flexible metal than stainless. It's more difficult to weld, too.
Up until recently, you've been doing all your own cutting, and I read that you use a laser cutter.
I have a plasma cutter.
What is a plasma cutter?
A plasma cutter is a machine that makes a plasma gas that accepts an electrical charge. So when it's directed in a concentrated fashion towards metal, it creates a short circuit, which melts the receiving metal.
And does that make it easier to cut circles, whereas a saw would be tougher?
On a curve? There's no limitations to what curve or straight line or anything. Plasma, like a laser, it's only where you move the line where it'll cut. But a saw blade cannot really make very, very tight curves. And cutting stainless with a saw is extremely difficult.
How has your work evolved from when you started working with these sculptures to where you're going now? Because I know you just did a big sculpture for the Rio Olympics, which was a major project, and that's a pretty nice thing to have done and, you know, created
a
spectacular piece. So what now? What next? Where are you going?
Oh, that's not easy. I'm just sort of recovering from the immensity of it, and the response has been fantastic.
How large is it?
There are actually two. This is a hazy point for a lot of people that are in the press that are writing about it. There's one in the Maracana Stadium, which is about 40 feet wide and weighs about 6,000 pounds.
Wow.
Has two electrical motors that power it. It would work by wind power if it was exposed to the wind.
Okay.
But in Maracana Stadium, there's not much wind. There's a second sculpture in downtown Rio in front of that Candelaria Church that is much smaller. It's about, top is about 10 feet wide, but the design is very similar. They both have cauldrons in front of them. The downtown one is always on. Flame, I think goes back to Americana for closing and then back downtown.
Wow.
But it's a bit like a bouncing ball. I'm not sure what's going on with the flame. It's kind of hard to keep track.
Do you have projects that you're working on now for the future in the works?
I have about 7, going on 8 large scale works under fabrication in Germany, in Zahner, in Kansas City, in Montreal, and also at the Walla Walla Foundry. And the biggest one of those is 35 feet high. And it's quite massive.
Where will that be going?
These have not been placed yet. There's a lot of requests for sculpture. There's a couple of museums that are interested, and various projects, airports, Mumbai Airport, Abu Dhabi Airport,
And those will be outdoors where the wind is operating them, or will they have motors?
All of those but one will be outdoors.
So to start the idea, does it start with a drawing? How do you, because they're so fantastic. They remind me some of them of molecular or water moving. When you're conceiving of them, what is your initial step in your creative process?
Well, the overriding thing in the back of my mind for a long time was to make them as least predictable as possible and as interesting as possible. The very first ones I made were very simple, like anemometers that just had on a single bearing that spun around, vertical axle. And then I started to push what was possible in terms of the design. Each design or each success would lead to the next sculpture.
Are there unsuccesses, like, you know, are there brick walls that have happened?
There were directions, you know, that were where I would couldn't see where help anywhere else to go with it, and I would stop. But the circle, which has kind of become my signature, with a circular axle, I've developed that to about as far. Well, I keep thinking that I've reached the end, and then something else happens.
Comes out of it.
And I spend thousands of hours pushing the designs, and mostly on the computer, to see where I can take them next.
And when did you start working on the computer? When did that step of it come in?
That came in about 10 years into it. I haven't done this for 30 years now. When we first moved here, the internet was really starting to take off. And the YouTube videos were also, that was just starting. With those videos on YouTube, my notoriety spread fairly quickly on the internet. The computer, when we first moved here 20 years ago, I started with Macs and started learning the 3D design software on the computers. I hadn't ever used one before that. For 10 years, I just would draw designs and build them, lots of drawings. The computer allowed me to get more complex and have a lot more different parts to mix up in the design. Definitely be very difficult to make some of the things I make now without a computer, to see the collisions of the parts. But there's still, at this point, I have a pretty good idea in my mind of what is involved in making these without even taking them to the computer. So it's about half and half.
So when you think that you've done everything you can do with the circle, and then you realize you can push it even further, what is going on in your mind? Like, in how are you pushing it further? What's happening?
I'm trying different shapes in different orbits around the circle, or not necessarily a circle. It could be a completely different figuration. It's as soon as you reach a point where you just think there's nowhere else to go, there usually is. And if you don't find it, somebody else will. But
it's interesting that you've been able to. You're not represented by a gallery, are you?
No, not now. I did the gallery thing for a while.
But it's kind of cool that you're known. Your work is all over the world. You just got into the Olympics without, representation. And you're out here on Orcas Island, this beautiful little island, removed, but you're still able to be a part of, the world art scene, actually.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because the way that we have done this is quite different than the normal path to success in the art world. I'm still not officially recognized in a lot of ways in the art world. I think that's going to change very soon. By not having a gallery and not having galleries for large, most intensive purposes, are there as a business to make money, and they can often not necessarily have a positive effect on your development. Since I haven't had one for so long, if I got an idea, there was nothing stopping me from trying it. And I could set my own prices for the work. I could change my prices. I could go up or down. The galleries, when you establish a certain level of where your work is supposed to sell at, it's very difficult to change that, especially to go down if you need to. It's So your life cycle, your lifespan in a gallery is tentative.
So you've got a lot more control.
Yeah, complete control.
Yeah.
And there may be times when I didn't want to work or I needed a break, and a gallery needs work to keep going, to pay their bills.
Yeah.
And the same thing with art consultants signing on with someone like that. It's problematic. We developed a very strong foundation with the land and our connection to the land and the being able to sell work off the property. We also ran this sculpture park here for 20 years, well, 17 years. And that was a constant source of income from sales. In a way, that was our gallery, that was our storefront. The other half of that, at least half of it, and maybe more now, was the internet. And the YouTube videos just have taken off. These various design blogs like Colossal, they've come with film crews and written up articles. And those, the last one was 28 million hits.
Wow.
On the Tech Insider's website. That kind of exposure is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
You can't run a storefront and you have 28 million people go through.
And that's through YouTube specifically.
Well, it was social media where it really took off. It was on Facebook. They have a Facebook page, and friends kept saying, Tony, you have to do the social media thing. That's where it's going to happen.
Do you focus a lot on social media, or is it other people coming in and doing a film like that and then they put it on social media?
Social media to me is like kitty litter. It's not really a big focus of my life. It just happened. I didn't really work on it, try to do anything. No.
So you've been on Orcas Island 20 years. You moved here from New York City that you were living before?
On the west side, yeah, in Chelsea.
When you decided you were no longer a painter and you were just getting started with the metal sculpture, was that a difficult transition financially? Was it difficult creatively, or were you just inspired? And
I was a runaway train, and the warehouse on West 25th Street had an endless supply of steel shelving. I did have to grind the paint off every piece of metal I used, but I had all the materials I needed.
So you would take steel shelving and cut it up into, that was just like, instead of ordering sheets of steel, you just used what was on hand.
Mm-hmm.
And would bend it through welding it? I mean, you'd have to heat it to bend it, or can you bend it just?
I used a lot of rod as well as sheet metal, and I did have to buy the steel rod, but steel rod isn't very expensive. Mm-hmm. Compared to fine oil paint and canvas, it wasn't expensive.
Yeah.
The most expensive part of that is buying the equipment.
To get started.
And I had a motorcycle. I sold everything. And but once I was going, I was incredibly prolific at that time. Not all of it was any good, but it was a lot of learning.
And you, it sounds like you felt like you knew you were on the right track.
I absolutely had no doubts.
Yeah, like you'd found your path, and it's just kept going.
Yeah, yeah.
That's incredible. So so you've got these large projects that you're working on now. They haven't been placed, but they're slated to go, like the Mumbai Airport. Is there one that is going to be going there, or you decide what goes where?
I don't decide, but I do think it's important at this point to try to place these things where more people can see them.
Mm-hmm.
Then we will sell to private collectors and that sort of thing, but it's preferable that they be seen by more people and more as public a place as possible.
Yeah.
I prefer to make them before they're sold.
Mm-hmm.
And test them. Just because it's important that they're going to work right, and I still have complete freedom if I haven't accepted any commission,
right,
to make them. And commissions can be tiring. It can be more work
tedious, I would think.
Tedious. They've always actually been more work to talk about and email about than they were to make in the end.
So what you prefer then is to create one out of what your goal with that particular piece is and then sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And
like paintings, the way a painter works.
Yeah.
No one tells a painter what to paint. Some sculptors are more open to a conversation about what it should look like. But in the case of mine, they're so idiosyncratic that that's not really, I don't think, at least not yet. The Olympics, there was a lot of conversation about what it should look like.
Did you have complete creative control then, or were they really saying we really have an idea of what we want, or you're presenting them with the possible ideas that you're willing to do?
That's what it was.
Okay.
Yeah. And I started off with some pretty far out things that would not have worked. And we actually, Fernando Morales, the creative director of the Olympics, had a design that he was fixated on. He said, this is what we're going to have this here. And he went to the Geneva Global Warming Conference and came back and said, no, we're making the sun. We're making something like the sun.
Which is a piece you had presented as a potential?
I had presented something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But after he said sun, then I came up with a more sun-like sculpture.
And did you do a piece for Burning Man a couple years ago? Did I see that on YouTube? Did that happen?
No.
No.
It was possible that it would have happened. It was supposed to happen, I should say. I thought I had a crew, and then when it came to actually putting your metal to the pedal, as they say, the crew wasn't around.
Oh.
And I thought it was, and after I built it and put it up in the back of my property, this massive 15,000 pound sculpture, I thought, I think I'll just sell this because I don't really want to move it around a lot.
Right.
And Burning Man is it's a difficult install.
Yeah,
it's
complicated. I can imagine.
And then there were difficulties. I said, I built this thing, I paid for it, and they're not used to that. And they didn't really understand that all I wanted was to move it down there and show it.
Right.
It all worked out well in the end.
And so, yeah, it looked beautiful what I saw. I was like,
I can't get into details on the record on that.
So... It's been about 30 years that you've been working with the metal, is that right?
Yeah. I used to use fiberglass sometimes.
Did you?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And there's some interior work that might be built that's going to be made with fiberglass.
Is that clear or white?
I think this one piece is going to be white. I've used epoxy before, too, and tried glass, but... Glass is too temperamental.
Right. Glass would be incredible, but you've got breakage. That would be, I think, inevitable. When you started with the metal 30 years ago, you did everything. You developed it, you welded it, you cut it, you just the whole thing. At what point did you start having somebody help with the actual putting it together? You know, like you said, in Germany, you're having something built. How many years ago did you... That's a long stretch to be doing things this complex, this large, this heavy. That's a long time to be operating all alone with the scale of some of this work that you've done.
Yeah, I only started having them made elsewhere really 5 months ago. And that really happened with the Olympics.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, it was partly due to the fact that my body was getting ground down, worn out, shoulder surgery and back problems from the construction.
And how many pounds is the big one at the Olympics?
It's 6,000.
6,000. So pounds. I mean,
yeah, no, I couldn't possibly build that in my shop. My shop's not big enough. But I also heavy equipment is essential. The bigger you get. And as I became more successful, it became possible to buy bigger and bigger machines to help make them.
It's really inspiring. And it's also great to see them in movement when they're videoed, because from every angle, it's a different view, and you can experience it without actually, for people who can't be here in person to see them, they get a real feel for, you know, the different, the piece looks different from every angle.
Yeah. Well, right now I'm kind of thinking about making some interactive virtual reality, like a virtual reality sculpture park, where you can walk around in virtual reality and get as close as you want and look up into it.
How would you, would that have to be created through a computer program?
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah.
I'm working with Unreal Engine, game engine,
mm-hmm.
to see what this is like. And if it'll work. I mean, it already has worked. And I will, like, real estate is being sold with virtual reality now.
Right.
It's such an obvious thing to sell sculpture that way.
Yeah, that's really exciting. Well, this has been an incredible pleasure.
Oh, me too.
And thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
And good luck with your projects in the future.
Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.